standing there, he realized, all at once, that he had acquired an overt, incontestable fear directed toward the principal android. It all hung on Batty. Had hung on it from the start. Up to now, he had encountered and retired progressively more ominous manifestations of Batty. Now came Batty itself. Thinking that, he felt the fear grow. It snared him completely, now that he had let it approach his conscious mind. "I can't go without you now," he said to Rachel. "I can't even leave here. Polakoff came after me. Garland virtually came after me. You think Roy Batty will look you up?" Setting down her empty glass, she bent forward, reached back, and unfastened her bra. With agility, she slid it from her, then stood, swaying and grinning because she swayed. "In my purse," she said, "I have a mechanism which our autofac on Mars builds as an she grimaced. "An emergency safety thingamajing jig. While they're putting a newly made Andy through its routine inspection checks. Get it out. It resembles an oyster. You'll see it." He began hunting through the purse. Like a human woman, Rachel had every class of object conceivable filched and hidden away in her purse. He found himself rooting interminably. Meanwhile, Rachel kicked off her boots and unzipped her shorts. Balancing on one foot, she caught the discarded fabric with her toe and tossed it across the room. She then dropped onto the bed, rolled over to fumble for her glass, accidentally pushed the glass to the carpeted floor. "Damn," she said, and once again got shakily to her feet. In her underpants, she stood watching him at work on her purse, and then, with careful deliberation and attention, she drew the bed covers back, got in, drew the covers over her. "Is this it?" He held up a metallic sphere with a button stem projecting. "That cancels an android into catalepsy," Rachel said, her eyes shut. "For a few seconds. Suspends its respiration. Yours too, but humans can function without respiring, perspiring, for a couple of minutes, but the vagus nerve of an Andy..." "I know." He straightened up. "The android autonomic nervous system isn't as flexible at cutting in and out as ours. But as you say, this wouldn't work for more than 5 or 6 seconds. "Long enough," Rachel murmured, "to save your life." "So, see?" She roused herself, sat up in the bed. "If Roy Batty shows up here, you can be holding that in your hand and you can press the stem on that thing. And while Roy Batty is frozen stiff with no air supply to his blood and his brain cells deteriorating, you can kill Roy Batty with your laser." "You have a laser tube," he said, "in your purse."
"A fake."
"Androids," she yawned, eyes again shut, "aren't permitted to carry lasers." He walked over to the bed. Squirming about, Rachel managed to roll over at last onto her stomach, face buried in the white lower sheet. "This is a clean, noble, virgin type of bed," she stated. "Only clean, noble girls who..." She pondered. "Androids can't bear children," she said then. "Is that a loss?" He finished undressing her, exposed her pale, cold loins. "Is it a loss?" Rachel repeated.
I don't really know. I have no way to tell. How does it feel to have a child? How does it feel to be born, for that matter? We're not born. We don't grow up. Instead of dying from illness or old age, we wear out like ants. Ants, again, that's what we are. Not you, I mean me. Chitinous reflex machines who aren't really alive. She twisted her head to one side, said loudly, I'm not alive. You're not going to bed with a woman. Don't be disappointed, okay? Have you ever made love to an android before? No, he said, taking off his shirt and tie. I understand. They tell me it's convincing if you don't think too much about it. But if you think too much, if you reflect on what you're doing, then you can't go on. For, physiological reasons. Bending, he kissed her bare shoulder. Thanks, Rick, she said wanly. Remember, though, don't think about it. Just do it. Don't pause and be philosophical, because from a philosophical standpoint, it's dreary. For us both. He said, afterward, I still intend to look for Roy Batty. I still need you to be there. I know that laser tube you have in your purse is... You think I'll retire one of your Andes for you? I think, in spite of what you said, you'll help me all you can. Otherwise, you wouldn't be lying there in that bed. I love you, Rachel said. If I entered a room and found a sofa covered with your hide, I'd score very high on the Voight-Kampff test. Tonight, sometime, he thought as he clicked off the bedside light, I will retire a Nexus 6 which looks exactly like this naked girl. My good God, he thought. I've wound up where Phil Resch said. Go to bed with her first, he remembered. Then kill her. I can't do it, he said, and backed away from the bed. I wish you could, Rachel said. Her voice wavered. Not because of you. Because of Pris Stratton. What I have to do to her. We're not the same. I don't care about Pris Stratton. Listen. Rachel thrashed about in the bed, sitting up. In the gloom, he could dimly make out her almost breastless, trim shape. Go to bed with me, and I'll retire Stratton. Okay? Because I can't stand getting this close and then... Thank you, he said. Gratitude, undoubtedly because of the bourbon, rose up inside him, constricting his throat. Two, he thought. I now have only two to retire. Just the baddies. Would Rachel really do it? Evidently. Androids thought and functioned that way. Yet he had never come across anything quite like this. God damn it. Get into bed, Rachel said. He got into bed. Chapter 17. Afterward, they enjoyed a great luxury. Rick had room service bring up coffee. He sat for a long time within the arms of a green, black, and gold-leaf lounge chair, sipping coffee and meditating about the next few hours. Rachel, in the bathroom, squeaked and hummed and splashed in the midst of a hot shower. "You made a good deal when you made that deal," she called when she had shut off the water. Dripping, her hair tied up with a rubber band, she appeared bare and pink at the bathroom door. "We androids can't control our physical, sensual passions. You probably knew that. In my opinion, you took advantage of me." She did not, however, appear genuinely angry. If anything, she had become cheerful, and certainly as human as any girl he had known. "Do we really have to go track down those three Andes tonight?" "Yes," he said. "Two for me to retire," he thought. "One for you." As Rachel put it, the deal had been made. Gathering a giant white bath towel about her, Rachel said, "Did you enjoy that?" "Yes." "Would you ever go to bed with an android again?" "If it was a girl. If she resembled you." Rachel said, "Do you know what the lifespan of a humanoid robot such as myself is? I've been in existence 2 years. How long do you calculate I have?" After a hesitation, he said, "About 2 more years. "They never could solve that problem. I mean, cell replacement. Perpetual, or anyhow, semi-perpetual renewal." "Well, so it goes." Vigorously, she began drying herself. Her face had become expressionless. "I'm sorry," Rick said. "Hell," Rachel said. "I'm sorry I mentioned it. Anyhow, it keeps humans from running off and living with an android." "And this is true with you Nexus 6 types too?" "It's the metabolism, not the brain unit." She trotted out, swept up her underpants, and began to dress. He too dressed. Then together, saying little, the two of them journeyed to the roof field, where his hover car had been parked by the pleasant, white-clad human attendant. As they headed toward the suburbs of San Francisco, Rachel said, "It's a nice night." "My goat is probably asleep by now," he said. "Or maybe goats are nocturnal. Some animals never sleep. Sheep never do, not that I could detect. Whenever you look at them, they're looking back, expecting to be fed." "What sort of wife do you have?" He did not answer. "Do you... if you weren't an android," Rick interrupted, "if I could legally marry you, I would." Rachel said, "Or we could live in sin, except that I'm not alive." "Legally, you're not. But really, you are. Biologically. You're not made out of transistorized circuits like a false animal. You're an organic entity. And in 2 years, he thought, you'll wear out and die. Because we never solved the problem of cell replacement, as you pointed out. So I guess it doesn't matter anyhow. This is my end," he said to himself, "as a bounty hunter. After the baddies, there won't be any more. Not after this, tonight."
"You look so sad," Rachel said.
Putting his hand out, he touched her cheek.
"You're not going to be able to hunt androids any longer," she said calmly. "So don't look sad. Please."
He stared at her.
"No bounty hunter ever has gone on," Rachel said, "after being with me. Except one. A very cynical man.
Phil Resch.
and he's nutty. He works out in the left field on his own.
I see, Rick said. He felt numb. Completely. Throughout his entire body.
But this trip we're taking, Rachel said, won't be wasted. Because you're going to meet a wonderful, spiritual man.
Roy Batty, he said. Do you know all of them?
I knew all of them, when they still existed. I know three now. We tried to stop you this morning, before you started out with Dave Holden's list. I tried again just before Polakoff reached you. But then after that, I had to wait.
Until I broke down, he said, and had to call you.
Luba Luft and I had been close, very close friends for almost 2 years. What did you think of her? Did you like her?
I liked her.
But you killed her.
Phil Resch killed her.
Oh. So Phil accompanied you back to the opera house. We didn't know that. Our communications broke down about then. We knew just that she had been killed. We naturally assumed by you.
From Dave's notes, he said, I think I can still go ahead and retire Roy Batty. But maybe not Irmgard Batty. And not Pris Stratton, he thought. Even now, even knowing this. So all that took place at the hotel, he said, consisted of a...
The association, Rachel said, wanted to reach the bounty hunters here and in the Soviet Union. This seemed to work. For reasons which we do not fully understand. Our limitation again, I guess.
I doubt if it works as often or as well as you say, he said thickly.
But it has with you.
We'll see.
I already know, Rachel said. When I saw that expression on your face, that grief, I look for that.
How many times have you done this?
I don't remember. 7, 8. No, I believe it's 9.
She, or rather, it, nodded.
Yes, 9 times.
The idea is old-fashioned, Rick said. Startled, Rachel said,
What?
Pushing the steering wheel away from him, he put the car into a gliding decline. Or anyhow, that's how it strikes me. I'm going to kill you, he said, and go on to Roy and Irmgard Batty and Pris Stratton alone.
That's why you're landing?
Apprehensively, she said,
There's a fine. I'm the property, the legal property of the association. I'm not an escaped android who fled here from Mars. I'm not in the same class as the others.
But, he said, if I can kill you, then I can kill them. Her hands dived for her bulging, overstuffed, kipple-filled purse. She searched frantically, then gave up.
God damn this purse, she said with ferocity. I never can lay my hands on anything in it. Will you kill me in a way that won't hurt? I mean, do it carefully. If I don't fight. Okay? I promise not to fight. Do you agree?
Rick said, I understand now why Phil Resch said what he said. He wasn't being cynical. He had just learned too much.
going through this. I can't blame him. It warped him. But the wrong way. She seemed more externally composed now, but still fundamentally frantic and tense. Yet the dark fire waned. The life force oozed out of her, as he had so often witnessed before with other androids. The classic resignation. Mechanical, intellectual acceptance of that which a genuine organism, with 2 billion years of the pressure to live and evolve hagriding it, could never have reconciled itself to. I can't stand the way you androids give up, he said savagely. The car now swooped almost to the ground. He had to jerk the wheel toward him to avoid a crash. Braking, he managed to bring the car to a staggering, careening halt. He slammed off the motor and got out his laser tube. At the occipital bone, the posterior base of my skull, Rachel said. Please. She twisted about so that she did not have to look at the laser tube. The beam would enter unperceived. Putting his laser tube away, Rick said, I can't do what Phil Resch said. He snapped the motor back on, and a moment later they had taken off again. If you're ever going to do it, Rachel said, do it now. Don't make me wait. I'm not going to kill you. He steered the car in the direction of downtown San Francisco once again. Your car's at the St. Francis, isn't it? I'll let you off there and you can head for Seattle. That ended what he had to say. He drove in silence. Thanks for not killing me, Rachel said presently. Hell, as you said, you've only got 2 years of life left anyhow. And I've got 50. I'll live 25 times as long as you. But you really look down on me, Rachel said. For what I did. Assurance had returned to her. The litany of her voice picked up pace. You've gone the way of the others. The bounty hunters before you. Each time they get furious and talk wildly about killing me, but when the time comes, they can't do it. Just like you. Just now. She lit a cigarette, inhaled with relish. You realize what this means, don't you? It means I was right. You won't be able to retire any more androids. It won't be just me. It'll be the baddies in Stratton, too. So go on home to your goat and get some rest. Suddenly, she brushed at her coat violently. I got a burning ash from my cigarette. There, it's gone. She sank back against the seat, relaxing. He said nothing. That goat, Rachel said. You love the goat more than me. More than you love your wife, probably. First the goat, then your wife, then last of all. She laughed merrily. What can you do but laugh? He did not answer. They continued in silence for a while, and then Rachel poked about, found the car's radio, and switched it on. Turn it off, Rick said. Turn off Buster Friendly and his friendly friends? Turn off Amanda Verner and Oscar Scruggs? It's time to hear Buster's big sensational expose, which is finally almost arrived. She stooped to read the dial of her watch by the radio's light. Very soon now. Did you already know about it? He's been talking about it, building up to it for... The radio said,
I just want to tell you folks that I'm sitting here with my pal Buster, and we're talking and having a real mighty fine time, waiting expectantly as we are with each tick of the clock for what I understand is the most important announcement of... Rick shut the radio off.
Oscar Scruggs, he said. The voice of intelligent man. Instantly reaching, Rachel clicked the radio back on.
I want to listen. I intend to listen. This is important, what Buster Friendly has to say on his show tonight.
The idiotic voice babbled once more from the speaker, and Rachel Rosen settled back and made herself comfortable. Beside him in the darkness, the coal of her cigarette glowed like the rump of a complacent lightning bug. A steady, unwavering index of Rachel Rosen's achievement. Her victory over him.
Chapter 18. Bring the rest of my property up here, Pris ordered J.R. Isidore. In particular, I want the TV set, so we can hear Buster's announcement.
Yes,
Ermgard Batty agreed, bright-eyed like a darting plumed swift.
We need the TV. We've been waiting a long time for tonight, and now it'll be starting soon.
Isidore said, My own set gets the government channel. Off in a corner of the living room, seated in a deep chair as if he intended to remain permanently, as if he had taken up lodgings in the chair, Roy Batty belched and said patiently, It's Buster Friendly and his friendly friends that we want to watch, Iz. Or do you want me to call you J.R.? Anyhow, do you understand? So will you go get the set? Alone, Isidore made his way down the echoing, empty hall to the stairs. The potent, strong fragrance of happiness still bloomed in him, the sense of being, for the first time in his dull life, useful.
Others depend on me now.
He exulted as he trudged down the dust-impacted steps to the level beneath.
And, he thought, it'll be nice to see Buster Friendly on TV again, instead of just listening on the radio in the store truck.
And that's right, he realized. Buster Friendly is going to reveal his carefully documented sensational exposé tonight. So, because of Pris and Roy and Ermgard, I get to watch what will probably be the most important piece of news to be released in many years.
How about that? He said to himself.
Life, for J.R. Isidore, had definitely taken an upswing. He entered Pris's former apartment, unplugged the TV set, and detached the antenna. The silence, all at once, penetrated. He felt his arms grow vague. In the absence of the baddies and Pris, he found himself fading out, becoming strangely like the inert television set which he had just unplugged.
You have to be with other people, he thought,
in order to live at all.
I mean, before they came here, I could stand it, being alone in the building. But now, it's changed. You can't go back, he thought. You can't go from people to non-people.
In panic, he thought,
I'm dependent on them. Thank God they stayed.
It would require two trips to transfer Pris's possessions to the apartment above. Hoisting the TV set, he decided to take it first, then the suitcases and remaining clothes. A few minutes later, he had gotten the TV set upstairs.
His fingers groaning, he placed it on a coffee table in his living room. The baddies and Pris watched impassively.
"We got a good signal in this building," he panted as he plugged in the cord and attached the antenna. "When I used to get Buster Friendly and his..."
"Just turn the set on," Roy Batty said, "and stop talking." He did so, then hurried to the door.
"One more trip," he said. "We'll do it."
He lingered, warming himself at the hearth of their presence.
"Fine,"
Pris said remotely. Isidore started off once more.
"I think," he thought, "they're exploiting me, sort of."
But he did not care.
"They're still good friends to have," he said to himself.
Downstairs again, he gathered the girls' clothing together, stuffed every piece into the suitcases, then labored back down the hall once again and up the stairs. On a step ahead of him, something small moved in the dust. Instantly, he dropped the suitcases. He whipped out a plastic medicine bottle, which, like everyone else, he carried for just this. A spider, undistinguished, but alive. Shakily, he eased it into the bottle and snapped the cap, perforated by means of a needle, shut tight. Upstairs, at the door of his apartment, he paused to get his breath.
"Yes, sir, folks, the time is now. This is Buster Friendly, who hopes and trusts you're as eager as I am to share the discovery which I've made, and by the way, had verified by top trained research workers working extra hours over the past weeks. Ho-ho, folks, this is it."
John Isidore said,
"I found a spider."
The three androids glanced up, momentarily moving their attention from the TV screen to him.
"Let's see it," Pris said.
She held out her hand. Roy Batty said, "Don't talk while Buster is on."
"I've never seen a spider," Pris said.
She cupped the medicine bottle in her palms, surveying the creature within.
"Oh, those legs. Why does it need so many legs, J.R.?"
"That's the way spiders are," Isidore said, his heart pounding. He had difficulty breathing.
"Eight legs."
Rising to her feet, Pris said,
"You know what I think, J.R.? I think it doesn't need all those legs."
"Eight," Ermgard Batty said.
"Why couldn't it get by on four? Cut four off and see."
Impulsively opening her purse, she produced a pair of clean, sharp cuticle scissors, which she passed to Pris. A weird terror struck at J.R. Isidore. Carrying the medicine bottle into the kitchen, Pris seated herself at J.R. Isidore's breakfast table. She removed the lid from the bottle and dumped the spider out.
"It probably won't be able to run as fast," she said.
"But there's nothing for it to catch around here anyhow. It'll die anyway." She reached for the scissors.
"Please,"
Isidore said. Pris glanced up inquiringly.
"Is it worth something?" "Don't mutilate it," he said wheezingly,
imploringly. With the scissors, Pris snipped off one of the spider's legs. In the living room, Buster Friendly on the TV screen said,
"Take a look at this enlargement of a section of background. This is the sky you usually see. Wait, I'll have Earl Parameter, head of my research staff, explain their virtually world-shaking discovery to you."
Pris clipped off another leg, restraining the spider with the edge of her hand. She was smiling.
"Blow-ups of the video pictures," a new voice from the TV said. "When subjected to rigorous laboratory scrutiny, reveal that the gray backdrop of sky and daytime moon against which Mercer moves is not only not Terran, it is artificial."
"You're missing it," Ermgard called anxiously to Priss. She rushed to the kitchen door, saw what Priss had begun doing.
"Oh, do that afterward," she said coaxingly. "This is so important, what they're saying. It proves that everything we believed..."
"Be quiet," Roy Batty said.
"Is true," Ermgard finished.
The TV set continued. "The moon is painted. In the enlargements, one of which you see now on your screen, brush strokes show. And there is even some evidence that the scraggly weeds and dismal, sterile soil, perhaps even the stones hurled at Mercer by unseen, alleged parties, are equally faked. It is quite possible, in fact, that the stones are made of soft plastic, causing no authentic wounds."
"In other words," Buster Friendly broke in, "Wilbur Mercer is not suffering at all."
The research chief said, "We at last managed, Mr. Friendly, to track down a former Hollywood special effects man, a Mr. Wade Corteau, who flatly states from his years of experience that the figure of Mercer could well be merely some bit player marching across a sound stage. Corteau has gone so far as to declare that he recognizes the stage as one used by a now out-of-business minor movie maker with whom Corteau had various dealings several decades ago."
"So according to Corteau," Buster Friendly said, "there can be virtually no doubt."
Priss had now cut three legs from the spider, which crept about miserably on the kitchen table, seeking a way out, a path to freedom. It found none.
"Quite frankly, we believed Corteau," the research chief said in his dry, pedantic voice. "And we spent a good deal of time examining publicity pictures of bit players once employed by the now defunct Hollywood movie industry."
"And you found?"
"Listen to this," Roy Batty said.
Ermgard gazed fixedly at the TV screen, and Priss had ceased her mutilation of the spider. "We located, by means of thousands upon thousands of photographs, a very old man now named Al Jarry, who played a number of bit parts in pre-war films. From our lab, we sent a team to Jarry's home in East Harmony, Indiana. I'll let one of the members of that team describe what he found."
Silence. Then a new voice, equally pedestrian.
"The house on Lark Avenue in East Harmony is tottering and shabby, and at the edge of town, where no one except Al Jarry still lives. Invited amiably in, and seated in the stale-smelling, moldering, kipple-filled living room, I scanned, by telepathic means, the blurred, debris-cluttered, and hazy mind of Al Jarry, seated across from me."
"Listen," Roy Batty said, on the edge of his seat, poised as if to pounce.
"I found," the technician continued, "that the old man did, in actuality, make a series of short 15-minute video films for an employer whom he never met. And, as we had theorized, the rocks did consist of rubber-like plastic. The blood shed was ketchup and..."
The technician chuckled. The only suffering Mr. Jari underwent was having to go an entire day without a shot of whiskey.
"Al Jari," Buster Friendly said, his face returning to the screen. "Well, well. An old man who even in his prime never amounted to anything which either he or ourselves could respect. Al Jari made a repetitious and dull film, a series of them, in fact, for whom he knew not, and does not to this day. It has often been said by adherents of the experience of Mercerism that Wilbur Mercer is not a human being, that he is, in fact, an archetypal superior entity, perhaps from another star. Well, in a sense, this contention has proven correct. Wilbur Mercer is not human, does not, in fact, exist. The world in which he climbs is a cheap, Hollywood, commonplace soundstage which vanished into kipple years ago. And who, then, has spawned this hoax on the Sol system? Think about that for a time, folks.
We may never know,
Irmgard murmured. Buster Friendly said, We may never know. Nor can we fathom the peculiar purpose behind this swindle. Yes, folks, swindle. Mercerism is a swindle. I think we know, Roy Batty said. It's obvious. Mercerism came into existence. But ponder this, Buster Friendly continued. Ask yourselves what is it that Mercerism does? Well, if we're to believe its many practitioners, the experience fuses. It's that empathy that humans have, Irmgard said. Men and women throughout the Sol system into a single entity. But an entity which is manageable by the so-called telepathic voice of Mercer. Mark that. An ambitious, politically minded would-be Hitler could...
No. It's that empathy, Irmgard said vigorously.
Fists clenched, she roved into the kitchen, up to Isidore.
Isn't it a way of proving that humans can do something we can't do? Because without the Mercer experience, we just have your word that you feel this empathy business, this shared group thing.
How's the spider? She bent over Priss's shoulder. With the scissors, Priss snipped off another of the spider's legs.
Four now, she said.
She nudged the spider.
He won't go, but he can.
Roy Batty appeared at the doorway, inhaling deeply, an expression of accomplishment on his face.
It's done.
Buster said it out loud, and nearly every human in the system heard him say it. Mercerism is a swindle. The whole experience of empathy is a swindle. He came over to look curiously at the spider.
It won't try to walk, Irmgard said.
I can make it walk. Roy Batty got out a book of matches, lit a match. He held it near the spider, closer and closer, until at last it crept feebly away.
I was right, Irmgard said. Didn't I say it could walk with only four legs?
She peered up expectantly at Isidore.
What's the matter?
Touching his arm, she said,
You didn't lose anything. We'll pay you what that... What's it called? That Sydney's catalog says. Don't look so grim. Isn't that something about Mercer, what they discovered? All that research? Hey, answer. She prodded him anxiously.
He's upset, Pris said, because he has an empathy box in the other room.
Do you use it, J.R.? She asked Isidore. Roy Batty said, of course he uses it. They all do. Or did. Maybe now they'll start wondering.
I don't think this will end the cult of Mercer, Pris said. But right this minute, there are a lot of unhappy human beings.
To Isidore, she said,
we've waited for months. We all knew it was coming, this pitch of Buster's.
She hesitated and then said,
well, why not? Buster is one of us.
An android, Ermgard explained. And nobody knows. No humans, I mean. Pris, with the scissors, cut yet another leg from the spider. All at once, John Isidore pushed her away and lifted up the mutilated creature. He carried it to the sink, and there he drowned it. In him, his mind, his hopes drowned too, as swiftly as the spider.
He's really upset, Ermgard said nervously.
Don't look like that, J.R. And why don't you say anything? To Pris and to her husband, she said, it makes me terribly upset, him just standing there by the sink and not speaking. He hasn't said anything since we turned on the TV.
It's not the TV, Pris said. It's the spider. Isn't it, John R. Isidore?
He'll get over it, she said to Ermgard, who had gone into the other room to shut off the TV. Regarding Isidore with easy amusement, Roy Batty said,
it's all over now, Iz.
For Mercerism, I mean. With his nails, he managed to lift the corpse of the spider from the sink.
Maybe this was the last spider, he said.
The last living spider on Earth. He reflected. In that case, it's all over for spiders, too.
I don't feel well, Isidore said.
From the kitchen cupboard, he got a cup. He stood holding it for an interval. He did not know exactly how long. And then he said to Roy Batty,
is the sky behind Mercer just painted?
Not real? You saw the enlargements on the TV screen, Roy Batty said. The brush strokes.
Mercerism isn't finished, Isidore said.
Something ailed the three androids. Something terrible.
The spider, he thought.
Maybe it had been the last spider on Earth, as Roy Batty said. And the spider is gone. Mercer is gone. He saw the dust and the ruin of the apartment as it lay spreading out everywhere. He heard the kipple coming, the final disorder of all forms, the absence which would win out. It grew around him as he stood holding the empty ceramic cup. The cupboards of the kitchen creaked and split, and he felt the floor beneath his feet give. Reaching out, he touched the wall. His hand broke the surface. Gray particles trickled and hurried down, fragments of plaster resembling the radioactive dust outside. He seated himself at the table, and, like rotten, hollow tubes, the legs of the chair bent. Standing quickly, he set down the cup and tried to reform the chair, tried to press it back into its right shape. The chair came apart in his hands. The screws which had previously connected its several sections ripping out and hanging loose. He saw, on the table, the ceramic cup crack. Webs of fine lines grew like the shadows of a vine, and then a chip dropped from the edge of the cup, exposing the rough, unglazed interior.
"What's he doing?"
Ermengarde Batty's voice came to him distantly.
"He's breaking everything. Isidore, stop!"
"I'm not doing it," he said. He walked unsteadily into the living room to be by himself. He stood by the tattered couch and gazed at the yellow-stained wall with all the spots which dead bugs that had once crawled had left. And again he thought of the corpse of the spider with its four remaining legs. "Everything in here is old," he realized. "It long ago began to decay, and it won't stop. The corpse of the spider has taken over." In the depression caused by the sagging of the floor, pieces of animals manifested themselves. The head of a crow, mummified hands which might have once been parts of monkeys. A donkey stood a little way off, not stirring and yet apparently alive. At least it had not begun to deteriorate. He started toward it, feeling stick-like bones, dry as weeds, splinter under his shoes. But before he could reach the donkey, one of the creatures which he loved the most, a shiny blue crow fell from above to perch on the donkey's unprotesting muzzle. "Don't," he said aloud. But the crow rapidly picked out the donkey's eyes. "Again," he thought. "It's happening to me again. I will be down here a long time," he realized. "As before. It's always long, because nothing here ever changes. A point comes when it does not even decay." A dry wind rustled, and around him the heaps of bones broke. "Even the wind destroys them," he perceived. "At this stage, just before time ceases. I wish I could remember how to climb up from here," he thought. Looking up, he saw nothing to grasp. "Mercer," he said aloud, "where are you now? This is the tomb world, and I am in it again. But this time, you're not here, too." Something crept across his foot. He knelt down and searched for it, and found it because it moved so slowly. The mutilated spider, advancing itself haltingly on its surviving legs. He picked it up and held it in the palm of his hand. "The bones," he realized, "have reversed themselves. The spider is again alive. Mercer must be near." The wind blew, cracking and splintering the remaining bones, but he sensed the presence of Mercer. "Come here," he said to Mercer. "Crawl across my foot, or find some other way of reaching me. Okay?" "Mercer," he thought. Aloud, he said, "Mercer!" Across the landscape, weeds advanced. Weeds corkscrewed their way into the walls around him and worked the walls until the weeds became their own spore. The spore expanded, split, and burst within the corrupted steel and shards of concrete that had formerly been walls. but the desolation remained after the walls had gone. The desolation followed after everything else, except the frail, dim figure of Mercer. The old man faced him, a placid expression on his face.
"Is the sky painted?" Isidore asked. "Are there really brush strokes that show up under magnification?"
"Yes," Mercer said.
"I can't see them."
"You're too close," Mercer said.
"You have to be a long way off, the way the androids are. They have better perspective."
"Is that why they claim you're a fraud?"
"I am a fraud," Mercer said. "They're sincere. Their research is genuine. From their standpoint, I am an elderly, retired bit player named Al Jari. All of it, their disclosure, is true. They interviewed me at my home, as they claim. I told them whatever they wanted to know, which was everything."
"Including about the whiskey?"
Mercer smiled.
"It was true. They did a good job, and from their standpoint, Buster Friendly's disclosure was convincing. They will have trouble understanding why nothing has changed. Because you're still here, and I'm still here."
Mercer indicated with a sweep of his hand the barren, rising hillside, the familiar place.
"I lifted you from the tomb world just now, and I will continue to lift you until you lose interest and want to quit. But you will have to stop searching for me, because I will never stop searching for you."
"I didn't like that about the whiskey," Isidore said. "That's lowering."
"That's because you're a highly moral person. I'm not. I don't judge, not even myself."
Mercer held out a closed hand, palm up.
"Before I forget it, I have something of yours here."
He opened his fingers. On his hand rested the mutilated spider, but with its snipped-off legs restored.
"Thanks."
Isidore accepted the spider. He started to say something further. An alarm bell clanged. Roy Batty snarled, "There's a bounty hunter in the building. Get all the lights off. Get him away from that empathy box. He has to be ready at the door. Go on. Move him."
Chapter 19. Looking down, John Isidore saw his own hands. They gripped the twin handles of the empathy box. As he stood gaping at them, the lights in the living room of his apartment plunged out. He could see, in the kitchen, Pris hurrying to catch the table lamp there.
"Listen, J.R.," Ermgard whispered harshly in his ear. She had grabbed him by the shoulder, her nails digging into him with frantic intensity. She seemed unaware of what she did now. In the dim, nocturnal light from outdoors, Ermgard's face had become distorted, astigmatic. It had turned into a craven dish with cowering, tiny, lidless eyes.
"You have to go," she whispered, "to the door when he knocks, if he does knock. You have to show him your identification and tell him this is your apartment and no one else is here. and you ask to see a warrant.
Pris, standing on the other side of him, her body arched, whispered,
"Don't let him in, JR. Say anything. Do anything that will stop him. Do you know what a bounty hunter would do, let loose in here? Do you understand what he would do to us?"
Moving away from the two android females, Isidore groped his way to the door. With his fingers, he located the knob, halted there, listening. He could sense the hall outside, as he always had sensed it, vacant and reverberating and lifeless.
"Hear anything?" Roy Batty said, bending close.
Isidore smelled the rank, cringing body. He inhaled fear from it, fear pouring out, forming a mist.
"Step out and take a look."
Opening the door, Isidore looked up and down the indistinct hall. The air out here had a clear quality, despite the weight of dust. He still held the spider which Mercer had given him. Was it actually the spider which Pris had snipped apart with Ermengarde Batty's cuticle scissors? Probably not. He would never know. But anyhow, it was alive. It crept about within his closed hand, not biting him. As with most small spiders, its mandibles could not puncture human skin. He reached the end of the hall, descended the stairs, and stepped outside onto what had once been a terraced path, garden enclosed. The garden had perished during the war, and the path had ruptured in 1,000 places. But he knew its surface. Under his feet, the familiar path felt good, and he followed it, passed along the greater side of the building, coming at last to the only verdant spot in the vicinity, a yard-square patch of dust-saturated, drooping weeds. There, he deposited the spider. He experienced its wavering progress as it departed his hand. Well, that was that. He straightened up. A flashlight beam focused on the weeds. In its glare, their half-dead stalks appeared stark, menacing. Now he could see the spider. It rested on a serrated leaf. So it had gotten away, all right. "What did you do?" the man holding the flashlight asked.
"I put down a spider," he said, wondering why the man didn't see.
In the beam of yellow light, the spider bloated up larger than life.
"So it could get away."
"Why don't you take it up to your apartment? You ought to keep it in a jar. According to the January Sydneys, most spiders are up 10% in retail price. You could have gotten $100-some-odd for it."
Isidore said, "If I took it back up there, she'd cut it apart again, bit by bit, to see what it did."
"Androids do that," the man said. Reaching into his overcoat, he brought out something which he flapped open and extended toward Isidore. In the irregular light, the bounty hunter seemed a medium man. Not impressive. Round face and hairless, smooth features, like a clerk in a bureaucratic office. Methodical but informal. Not demigod in shape. Not at all as Isidore had anticipated him.
"I'm an investigator for the San Francisco Police Department. Deckard. Rick Deckard."
The man flapped his ID shut again, stuck it back in his overcoat pocket.
"They're up there now? The three?"
Well, the thing is, Isidore said, I'm looking after them. Two are women. They're the last ones of the group. The rest are dead. I brought Priss's TV set up from her apartment and put it in mine so they could watch Buster Friendly. Buster proved beyond a doubt that Mercer doesn't exist.
Isidore felt excitement, knowing something of this importance, news that the bounty hunter evidently hadn't heard.
Let's go up there, Deckard said. Suddenly, he held a laser tube pointed at Isidore. Then, indecisively, he put it away.
You're a special, aren't you? He said. A chicken head.
But I have a job. I drive a truck for...
Horrified, he discovered he had forgotten the name.
A pet hospital, he said. The Van Ness Pet Hospital, he said. Owned by Hannibal Sloat.
Deckard said, Will you take me up there and show me which apartment they're in? There are over 1,000 separate apartments. You can save me a lot of time. His voice dipped with fatigue.
If you kill them, you won't be able to fuse with Mercer again, Isidore said.
You won't take me up there? Show me which floor? Just tell me the floor. I'll figure out which apartment on the floor it is.
No, Isidore said.
Under state and federal law, Deckard began. He ceased then, giving up the interrogation. Good night, he said, and walked away, up the path and into the building, his flashlight bleeding a yellowed, diffuse path before him.